So one thing I should have mentioned yesterday is that in supersymmetry, one can prove, it's a little bit long, so I'm not going to do that, but one can prove that in supersymmetry multiplets contain the same number of fermions and bosons. That's why we were discussing the Carrier supermultiplet, and we say that we need to add these auxiliary fields because those match the number of degrees of freedom of shell. Yesterday we discussed the Carrier supermultiplet, and we say that it's composed by a scalar complex, by a wild fermion, and by a complex scalar, non-propagating scalar. That's the auxiliary field. And we finish by talking about the gauge or vector supermultiplet. Remember, we didn't do the whole derivation. Essentially, it has to contain your gauge boson. This is the adjoint index. It does contain a major and a fermion, again with the adjoint index. And to match the degrees of freedom, we need an auxiliary field. So let's talk about this matching degrees of freedom. So on shell, a massless gauge boson, how many degrees of freedom it has? At the photon, how many degrees of freedom? Two. Two polarizations, two transverse polarizations. So as of bosonic degrees of freedom, we get two, the transverse polarizations. And as of fermionic degrees of freedom, well, now we have a Majorana fermion. This is two, as we were discussing. So we had this counting for each value of this adjoint index. So in the case of SU3, for example, A runs from 1 to 8. So you're going to have 8 gluons and 8 Majorana fermions. What about off shell? How many degrees of freedom does have a gauge boson off shell? Any guess? It's good. Four? I don't. Why four? So it's a spin one particle. It has, in principle, three possible. It has two transverse and one longitudinal, right? So when it's massive, it acquires this longitudinal polarization, and an off-shell gauge boson has 3 degrees of freedom. So boson seems to be three, the transverse plus the longitudinal polarizations. And as we were discussing, the Majorana fermion, when it's off shell, has how many degrees of freedom? So it had two when it's on shell, and it had four when it's off shell. Very good. So to match the degrees of freedom of shell, how many bosonic degrees of freedom I need to add in this auxiliary scalar? At least one. We need one. So your D auxiliary field is going to be a scalar that carries only 1 degree of freedom. So we are going to say that it's a real scalar. So this guy is going to be real. In this case, the matching works with this guy having 2 degrees of freedom, and that's why F is a complex scalar. But here we just need one extra bosonic degree of freedom, so we impose that this guy, the D term, is real. Okay, so the Carrier supermultiplet is made up by these guys, and the gauge or vector supermultiplet is the gauge boson, Majorana fermion, and a real scalar. So all these things are assuming there are no interactions, but obviously we don't care about theories without interactions. We want theories where there are interactions, and writing down interactions inside the West Sumino model, or for example, now we want to describe the vectorial, the gauge interaction of these fermions here. All these things will take some time to develop, so we are going to take a shortcut. The shortcut is using the fact that the most Susie scenarios have a parity. Are parity. And we discussed, I think on Friday, the why this R parity is interesting to evade constraints and also to provide a dark matter candidate. But it's also very useful to know this R parity because the shortcut is to say the following. To write a supersymmetric interaction, what I had to do is to write a standard model interaction. What interaction do you want to write? Anyone? Ali? Like photon e plus e minus, okay? We do that. This QED interaction and now, imagine that we wanted to write a supersymmetric interaction. One thing we know for sure is because there is this R parity, any vertex with only one supersymmetric leg is going to be forbidden, right? So we need at least two supersymmetric legs. So to obtain supersymmetric interactions, the only thing you have to do, at least for this class, is to take the standard model interaction and take any two legs and supersymmetrize them. So instead of the photon, we can put the supersymmetric partner, and then we can choose one of these two guys and supersymmetrize it too. So we are going to have interactions of the type, this guy is the photon, the supersymmetric partner is called the photino. And then to allow an interaction in supersymmetry, because of R parity, I have to supersymmetrize at least one of the other, well, one of the other legs. So let's do this one. So I'm going to get a selectron. And this is a positron. So this guy is called selectron. We are going to write down the content of the minimal supersymmetric standard model, but just to get the feeling of interactions. So I can do that. This, yes. Exactly, yes, that's the big deal, yes. This is E, this is E2. Yes. Ah, yes. So what is R parity? R parity was this parity where the standard model doesn't care, it transforms trivially, and the SUSY particles transform with a minus sign. Okay, so if I just supersymmetrize one of the legs, I will get a minus. This vertex will violate the parity, so I do the two of them. Okay, so there is something at a vertex of a fermion called photino with a scalar called selectron and our well-known positron. Do I have more options? Like I took two of the legs and supersymmetrized them. I could also have decided to supersymmetrize the positron, but I can also keep the photon and supersymmetrize the two fermions. So you also have things like the photon, our regular photon, can produce two selectrons. So in particular, at LEP, if these guys were light enough, you could have produced an E plus E minus that goes to a photon, and this guy produces two selectrons. Yes?
You've written that under R parity, standard model versus standard model. and supersymmetry versus minor supersymmetry. Sorry, what does that mean?
Yes, so what it means is at the level of the, so you take your theory, you write a Lagrangian, right? And the Lagrangian will contain the Lagrangian of interactions, such as these ones. And what I'm saying is that at the level of the Lagrangian, there is a symmetry I'm imposing, where, for example, the photon field goes to the photon, but, for example, the Fotino field goes to the minus Fotino field. Exactly. So each of the vertices. Exactly, because if I do this thing here and the same for electrons and selectrons, then any interaction of this kind needs at least two of these guys. No, that's a very good question. Yes?
I don't understand. In the first case, the third vertex, this vertex has different dimensionality than the two before.
Okay. So you have a Fotino, which is a... You have a fermion, you have a Gauge boson and two fermions, right? Here you have a scalar and two fermions. Here you have a scalar, two scalars and a Gauge boson. So what is the dimensionality of this vertex? This is 3 and 1, 4. So the vertex itself is dimensionless. No, no, but that's very good. So that you check these kind of things, these obvious things. Right? This is 1, and this is a... that's 3. So these guys should have an insertion here. No? So that's very... Exactly. That's very good. Yes, so the coupling here will be E, but then the Feynman rule will have a derivative in one of the scalar legs. That's very good. Dimensions always you know, tell you something about the theory. Okay. So that's the trick, is to, at least in this class, it would be more than enough just to say, in terms of interactions, I know a standard model interaction. I know that the supersymmetric interactions that I can come up are just supersymmetrizations of the usual standard model. This is not always true. There's a particular case for non-abelian theories or a particular, you know, vertex, but we are never going to see it. So at least at the level of DMSSM, this is more than enough. Yes, Lena.
So if we have like a W boson and the supersymmetric particle will be charged, so how could it, like, why is it still a Majorana fermion?
So you're saying W boson, and then I'm going to supersymmetrize this guy.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get, in this case, a Wino. And this has an electric charge, and it's plus or minus. So you're asking me, how can I impose Majorana conditions to a fermion that is charged under electric charge. That's I think it's a very good question. The answer is a bit long, but we are going to go through the MSSM, and one of the sectors is charginos, and we will see this guy. I don't want to confuse you with a very shorthand answer, but yes, that's a very good question. Okay, more questions? Yes?
I didn't understand how you counted the dimensions.
Yes, so this vertex here, it has to be a vertex coming from the Lagrangian, right? Where I get a photon and two fermions, right? This guy has a dimension 1, mass dimension 1. These three halves. So when I sum just the field content, I get that the coupling should be dimensionless, right? To make this interaction renormalizable. Same here. So I do, this guy is 3 halves. This guy is 1, this guy is 3 halves, so I get the same thing. And what Aitor was saying is, well, look here, this is 1, 1, and 1. So the coupling has to still be E for because of supersymmetry, but in the Feynman rule, you need to get a derivative attached to one of the scalars.
So that's what's going to happen. And that will lower the dimension just to make it very. Essentially, this coupling is going to be E times some derivative attached to one of the scalar fields. And then the other scalar field, and then the photon.
We also need that for Lorentz.
Yes, in any case, because it's Sally, because this guy has an index and this is just a scalar. Well, I will need this guy. Okay. So next thing we are going to do is to, so now we know the two types of fields that appear in supersymmetry, the chiral superfield and the vector superfield. So we are going to talk about the simplest version of supersymmetry. This is called the minimal supersymmetric standard model. Okay. So the MSSM is the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So the first assumption for the MSSM is that you remember we were talking about the generators of supersymmetry, and then we say that these guys can come in several versions. So you can have not only one generator, but several. And then you say that your number of supersymmetries is 1 or 2 or 4 or 8 or 16, I think. Any question? Okay, so you could have a much more complicated structure in terms of supersymmetries. So in principle, we don't know if nature is supersymmetric, and we don't know if it's supersymmetric, which version is decided to use. But the MSSM is assuming that there is only one supersymmetry. Yes?
What's the problem with N, 3, 5?
When you look at the conditions for the commutation relations of these guys and anti-commutation relations, then you see that only these values are allowed. Nora, okay, this is not giving you an answer, but that's what happened. Okay, so in the MSSM, n equals 1, we don't care. So the standard model is often referred as n equals 0. That's the standard model. Okay. So that's one assumption, and what we are going to do is to take each particle of the standard model, and we are going to write down a supersymmetric version. So for each fermion, we'll get a boson. For each boson, we'll get a fermion. So that's adding a bunch of particles. For example, I can take the electron and the neutrino electron. There's U2 doublet for the first family. And then what I'm going to do, this is a left-handed guy. What I'm going to do is to write an SU2 doublet, but now instead of being a fermion, I'll write a scalar, and I put a tilde on top, is charged, and then I name it L. So it's the left-handed lepton. That's the left-handed lepton. Is there any meaning of a left-handedness or right-handedness for a scalar? No, there isn't. So the only reason why we call this lepton, this electron, this is called selectron, we call it left-handed, is just to say that it's the partner of the left-handed fermion. But by itself, it doesn't have a meaning. Okay, and instead of the neutrino, we put a tilde, usual stuff, and this guy is called S-neutrino. Yes?
Model, the transforming in a doublet of SU2, so it
In this case, yes. So it doesn't have a meaning in terms of helicities. It has a meaning in, it has a meaning in terms of how it couples to the W, for example. Yes. Very good. So the electron neutrino, we go to this electron and this neutrino. Let's take the quarks. Well, first the leptons go to its leptons. And the quarks go to its quarks. So for example, let's take the top and the bottom. Both guys left-handed. So this is going to be the top and this bottom. So that's the top guy. And this is this bottom. And then you can have lots of fun trying to pronounce sup or stum or stuff like this. It's very hard for a Spaniard to do this. So you can see that what I'm doing is taking fermions. I write the scalars instead of the fermions. And what I do is add an S in front of it. Right? So from a fermion, I'm writing a fermion. Yes.
Could you also take the fermions to spin one particle?
Yeah, so you could think that you can take these guys, and instead of lowering to spin zero, to increase it to spin one, right? This is not happening in the case of so these guys are chiral supermultiplets. And you remember the chiral supermultiplets have the fermion and the scalar and this guy. Yes.
S can be also thought of as standing for scalar.
Yes.
Because they are all supersymmetric.
Exactly. So you take the fermion and you supersymmetrize it by adding the S of scalar. Yes. So. That's for the fermionic, the matter sector of the standard model. What about the bosonic sector? The gauge or the forces of the standard model. So what you do is, for example, take the photon. We already say it goes to a photino. That goes to photino. Then the W and the Z go to a wino and a zino. That's wino and that's zino. And for example, the gluon, you will go to a gluino. Those guys are gauge fields. So the way to describe them in supersymmetry is using the vector supermultiplet. What about the Higgs sector? So you have a Higgs in the standard model, it's a boson, and this Higgs enters into a chiral supermultiplet, so we are going to get a fermion. It's called the Higgsino. So Higgsino. So in general, you take your standard model particle, let's say a boson, and you go to a bosino. And these guys are gauge bosons. So often you call these other guys gaugeinos. Okay. Okay. I think tomorrow we are going to go through all the sectors of the standard the minimal supersymmetric standard model, because there are subtleties there. All the neutral gauginos and the neutral components of the Higgsinos mix with each other, and same for the charged components. So we get a rather complicated sector there. The next thing I want to do is the following. I want to show you this miracle, if you want, of cancellations of quadratic divergences. So I told you, once the Higgs is inside this Cara supermultiplet, the protection of the Higgsino will protect as well the Higgs. But that's something you can see at the level of the Lagrangian, at the level of symmetries. But how do you see this in practice? Well, so what was the quadratic divergences for the Higgs sector? What is this big deal of the standard model hierarchy problem? The problem is that when we want to compute things like, for example, I want to compute what is the contribution to the Higgs mass from a loop of a fermion. Let's say this fermion is the fermion that couples the most to the standard model. Who is this fermion in the standard model? Who couples the most to the Higgs? The top, cool, because the mass is so large. And actually what happens is that the top has a coupling, and you have a coupling of order one to the Higgs, which is a strong coupling, whereas the gauge couplings are kind of suppressed for the electrophilic sector. Okay, so yeah, we have this top guy. Let's just call it a fermion. We have F and F bar, and we want to obtain this contribution. So let's call this guy the polarization of the Higgs. And the idea is that contributions to the mass of the Higgs coming from this loop contribution is going to be precisely this guy, in this case, evaluated at P squared equals the mass of the Higgs. So I sit down and write a Lagrangian with a mass term for the Higgs. And then I want to know if I write this two-level mass for the Higgs, then how loop corrections are going to affect this two-level mass. So we have to compute this fermion loop. So this fermion loop is going to go as the number of fermions in this loop. So each of these fermions will contribute with one of these integrals. And the integral is just summing over d4k, then you get this loop factor 2 pi 4. You get a minus sign because you have a fermion there. And then you get the trace of the coupling. They say that the coupling of the Higgs to this fermion is given by minus I lambda F divided by the square root of 2, because I want to define this as being the U comma. And I put the propagator for my fermion. I write the coupling again. So again, the trace of this lambda F. And then I put the propagator for the antifermion. Okay. Right. So that's formally this loop contribution. Just goes NF, for assuming that there are NF fermions. Yes. Yes. We are assuming there are NF of these guys with mass MF, same mass and same coupling. And then what I'm doing is one of these guys is going to have momentum k, and the other, if I enter with momentum p, this is going to have p plus k. So I'm just getting the vertex, the propagator, the vertex, and the propagator. And then I close. And I don't know, did you do any loops in your classes? Okay, so you are used to change variables, to get from, to use the x and y variables for Feynman parametrization, no? But still, to compute the loop integral, you will need to at least introduce one of these Feynman. Ah, okay. So, essentially, the Feynman trick is just you have here these two propagators, and then you would like to write, well, first of all, what you say is that this is going to be k bar minus mf divided by k square minus mf square, so that you put all the gamma structure in the numerator. Yes, sorry. Thank you. As I told you, minus signs. Oh, yes, sure, sure. Thank you. Okay, that's good. So the first thing is you put all the gamma structure in the numerator, then you have a regular scalar denominator, and then you use this trick of saying, okay, so I have two denominators, this guy and this guy, and I'm going to say this. Two denominators, I'm going to write them formally as, let's see if I find it, yes. The integral from 0 to 1 of this parameter dx of a plus b minus a x and this guy square. What I do by that is to symmetrize the structure of these two propagators. So you never seen that then? Never? Okay. Cool. So obviously my class is not about doing loop integrals. So I'm going maybe to skip some of the steps. I'm going to tell you once you do these kind of tricks, which is adding these Feynman parameters, then doing some shift in the momentum, then you get something that looks as let's do this at zero momentum, assuming that the mass of the Higgs is going to be much smaller than the contribution we are going to get from this integral, which is what is going to happen. So let's do that. And what we get is 4nf, so lambda f over square root of 2 square, obviously, 1 over 16 pi square, that just comes from the loop integral, and then we get this integral over dx parameters from 0 to 1, and then the integral from 0, in this case to lambda square, over this y parameter. And now the integral is much simpler, just contains this guy. Okay. The point is that now this integral is very easy to do. And what you obtain is that this is going to go as nf lambda f squared over 8 pi squared. You get a minus lambda squared plus 6 mf squared log of lambda over mf minus something that just goes as the mass of the fermion squared. Those are the leading contributions, the quadratic and the logarithmic contributions. And then you get things that are of order 1 over lambda squared, so that they vanish as we send lambda to infinity. I guess the first thing you notice is, okay, so what is the degree, at least naively, the degree of divergence of this integral? We have four powers of momentum in the numerator, right? And how many in the denominator? How many do we have? How many powers of momentum there are in those denominators? Two, right? So naively, it looks like this integral, if you do it, is going to diverge as lambda squared. Because I'm going to integrate the momentum from, let's say, the infrared scale to the higher, largest scale I want to talk about. So it's going to go as this scale square. So by looking at the integral, you already know that you are going to run into trouble, that quadratic divergence. And when you do this integral with a cutoff, a explicit cutoff here of lambda, then you get indeed this contribution that goes as lambda squared, and then subleading contributions, a logarithmic contribution, something that just refers to the fermion mass, and something that vanishes as I send lambda to infinity. And we already discussed how this is an artifact of the way you are doing this integral by putting this cutoff by hand. So I'm putting the cutoff by hand. If you did dimensional regularization, you will then obtain this lambda square. You will obtain something that goes as 1 over epsilon. So it will look like in dimensional regularization, this quadratic divergence disappears. But as we discussed, this is not true because the physical meaning of this cutoff is that any new physics at a scale lambda is going to give a threshold contribution that goes as lambda squared. And even in dimensional regularization, you will get that threshold correction. So there is no way of avoiding this using tricks or mathematical tricks. So here we have this contribution. And what we were saying is even if I set the mass of the Higgs to 0, I'm going to get a contribution to the Higgs mass that goes as whatever high scale I have to the 2 square. That's pretty bad. So that's the origin of the hierarchy problem. And we say this is very specific of having a scalar and trying to obtain this kind of correction to the scalar mass. Whereas fermionic theories or theories with gauge bosons, there is a symmetry that tells you that any correction to the fermion mass is going to be proportional, not to any scale, but to the fermion mass itself. Gauge bosons have the same kind of protection. In this case, it's gauge symmetry. So it's really the question of the scalar. The scalar, once you look at the integral here, naively you will say it's quadratically divergent. And because there is no symmetry protecting the scalar, there is no way of avoiding this. Okay, so what do we do? Now I'm going to show you how in supersymmetry this quadratic divergence disappears. Okay. So assume that besides having this fermion loop, the Higgs couples to two new scalars. So think of these fermions as, you could think of only one fermion, the top, and then we want to see what happens to the top loop when we add the contribution of two new scalars. So what kind of vertexes we can have for the scalars? We can have the Higgs and the contribution of this phi 1, phi 2, this scalar. Let's call this two new scalars. And we could also have trilinear contributions. And this is the Higgs again, and this is phi 1 or 2 in running in the loop. Okay. So when we look at the contribution to the self-energy for the Higgs coming from these scalars, it goes as, I'm going to get an I, number of scalars, d4 k over 2 pi to the fourth. Let me call this vertex. Yes. Ah, yes, no, no reason. Just maybe my dyslexia, but yes. It's the Higgs, little Higgs, yes. Okay, cool. And let me call this coupling I lambda s, the coupling of the scalars to the Higgs. So I'm going to get I lambda s. And then I get a contribution that comes as k squared minus m1 squared plus a contribution that goes as k squared minus m2 squared. Sorry. So I should say this is I lambda s. So I'm writing a theory with a quartic coupling lambda s phi 1 or 2 squared and the Higgs squared. But when I have a theory like this in the broken phase, I also get a contribution that goes as lambda s phi 1 or 2 squared v. So I can substitute the value of the Higgs by v h. So whenever I have a quartic coupling of a theory that is spontaneously broken, I also get immediately a trilinear coupling. But now the coupling is dimensionful, and it goes as the VEF. Is it clear to you then? Okay. Yes?
The first term, what is that supersymmetrization
called? So we are going to get to that in a second. At the end of the day, what is going to happen is that this is the top contribution, and this is the stops contribution, where we are considering the left and right-handed stops. But I'm just showing, like, formally, you can always engineer a way, you can come up with a way of canceling this divergence. So, okay, so we get this from this contribution, the quartic coupling, plus we're going to get the same ns. Now I lambda s v squared. Because I get this trilinear coupling twice. So this is I lambda s v, this is I lambda s v. And I'm going to get d4 k 2 pi to the fourth. And then I had to put these two propagators. So I'm going to get 1 over k squared minus m1 squared. Plus I over k plus p squared minus m1 squared. So I'm just adding the contribution to the Higgs potential coming from just exchanging these phi ones. And then I have to sum the contribution from the second scalar. Okay. So again, let's look at this naive degree of divergence. This guy here, the first contribution from the quartic coupling, how does it go? Is it divergent or not? Quadratically divergent. We have four powers of momentum. We only have two in each denominator. So this is going to diverge as lambda squared. What about this guy? That's logarithmic. The integral itself is logarithmic, and on top of that, it's suppressed by the Liouville scale. Okay. Yes,
what is the
Yes, so the question is that the same way we have a Yukawa of a TT bar, right, with the Higgs, we also obtain, with the stops, we can get an interaction of this type, where the Higgs can interact with, for example, stuff left or right, stuff left or right. So it's a quartic interaction that appears in supersymmetry. Something you can write down for for scalars, and you cannot write it down for fermions. But for the moment, the idea is we are going to just assume that there are some scalars and see if there is any chance that these scalars cancel the contribution from the fermion. Okay, so this is the fermionic contribution. Same story. We simplify this integral using a standard procedure. And by imposing some cutoff lambda in the integral, then we are going to get that the scalar contribution goes as delta mh squared goes as lambda s and s divided by 16 pi squared. That goes as minus 2 lambda squared plus 2 and 1 squared a log plus 2 squared a log of lambda over n2. That's the contribution from the first two terms. So each of them gives you a quadratic divergence. That's why there is a 2 here. And then, on top of the quadratic divergence, the same as here, we obtain a logarithmic divergence that goes as the mass of the scalar, in this case, squared. And then from the second term, we get something like lambda s squared, v squared, and s over 16 pi squared. We get a minus 2 plus, as we expected, the worst we get in the with the second terms, with the electroweak symmetry breaking terms, is a logarithmic divergence. In this case, there is a 2 log plus 2 log of lambda over n2. And the rest of the terms are 1 over lambda squared. So now, if we focus on the terms that lead to the quadratic divergence, we can make them cancel with each other by imposing 1, that the number of scalars is the same as the number of fermionic contributions. 2, that the coupling square of the fermions goes as minus the scalar coupling. And for example, so that is enough as to kill the quadratic contributions. So that will lead to a 0 coefficient for the lambda squared. And all what we are left with is the logarithmic contributions. And now, if on top of that, you do the following, you say that MF is equals to M1 equals to M2. The mass of the scalars and the fermions are the same. So there is no contribution. And this is also important. So now assume that the mass of the fermions is not exactly the mass of the scalars. But for simplicity, let's do M1 equals M2, the two scalars having the same mass, but different from the fermion mass. Then we get that the correction to the Higgs mass, let me do this, no, the Higgs mass is going to go as the coupling, the number of fermions, 4 pi squared. And then it goes as the mass difference between the fermions and the scalars. And a log correction. Plus some term here that goes as 3 times the mass of the fermion squared. And a log of the ratio ms to mf. Okay, so I'll. No, no, yes. So, thinking about this again, we are just saying that if we have the same number of scalars and fermions, and as it happens, the fermion coupling and the scalar coupling have this particular relation, we get rid of the quadratic divergences. So, one way out of the hierarchy problem is to assume that there is a new sector of scalars. So for each fermion, there will be a new scalar with this particular coupling, making sure that there are no quadratic divergences. This looks pretty horrible, right? Like horrible in the sense that it's something you put by hand. Actually, this is a consequence of supersymmetry. So the idea is that it looks like this is just some kind of weird fine-tuning where the coupling of fermions and scalars has to be exactly the same, because if it's not exactly the same, here we will get a quadratic divergence because this guy won't be exactly zero. This is also a consequence of supersymmetry. So actually, all the corrections to the Higgs mass in supersymmetry are zero. So for each stop, we have a stop or a couple of stops making sure that this happens. And then in supersymmetry, the top and the stop have the same mass. So as a consequence, in supersymmetry, not only one loop contributions, but to all orders, there are no contributions to the Higgs mass. Okay, cool. So SUSY is a framework, it's a new extended framework that started by just asking yourself, okay, so I know there is one carrier symmetry, can I extend this in any way? And then people came up with this. Supersymmetry is the maximal extension you can think about. But as a byproduct of supersymmetry, you obtain this kind of very nice behavior. Essentially, this theory is very, very symmetric. So there are lots of conservation laws. In particular, you are not going to get any loop contributions to the Higgs mass. So is it the end of the story? Yes. Yes. So what is the weird thing here? I'm saying that the top has to have the same mass as a scalar called the stop. The top has been produced in Tevatron. Why didn't we see a stop? The reason is that supersymmetry in nature has to be broken. So let me show you something. First of all, let's talk about why in supersymmetry the scalars and the fermions have to have the same mass. This is a very simple derivation using the algebra of supersymmetry. So let's do that. So you remember the supersymmetric generators commute with translations, with p mu. So q and p mu commute with each other. In particular, that would mean that q and p squared commute with each other. So say that in the same supermultiplet, I have some bosons and some fermions, and I'm going to try to obtain a value for the masses of these bosons and fermions in the same supermultiplet. So what I know is that Q acting on the boson leads to the fermion. That's why they are in the same supermultiplet.
And I also know that P squared Q on the boson is the same as, I can exchange P squared and Q, so I just do Q P squared over the boson. But what is the operator P squared doing on the boson? It's giving me the mass of the boson. So I guess Q mass of the boson squared B. This is now a constant, so I just put it like this, right? So I get Q, sorry, mass of the boson squared Q on the boson. So let's do exactly the same here. I start with P squared Q on the boson. And what does Q on the boson, it just changes to the fermion. And what does P squared on the fermion do is to pull out the mass of the fermion. So if I go back here, I say that's going to be M boson squared. And this guy is, oops, precisely the fermion. So I compare these two things are exactly the same. So this guy and this guy had to be the same. And then you obtain that in a supermultiplet, the supersymmetric prediction is that the mass of the fermion and the boson had to be the same. Well, that's a very simple derivation. So indeed, a consequence of SUSY is that whenever I get a fermion, I get a boson, but they are degenerate with each other. And if that's the case, well, it's fantastic. I don't get any contributions whatsoever to the Higgs mass, and I have a super stable theory of a scalar. It looks like great, but as is it Andrew or what's your name? Your name? Henrik. As Henrik was saying, well, there's something fishy there, right? I'm saying that for the top, let's say, I should expect a scalar partner, the stop, at the same mass. We reached those masses at the bottom. We didn't see any scalar partner. So what's going on? Well, worse than the top, you could think on light particles. For example, as a consequence of supersymmetry, you should find that there is a guy, a scalar, this electron, as light as the electron. Or even worse, the mass of the photino should be the same as the mass of the photon, so zero. So you should find out that you have a massless fermionic degree of freedom. We couldn't miss something like this, right? If there was a massless degree of freedom out there different from our regular interactions, we would know. The same for this electron. Obtaining a scalar of mass 0.5 MeV should be everywhere. Yes. So they still, we are assuming our parity, right? So you are going to find out that the lightest of these supersymmetric particles cannot decay to anything. So that's going to be stable. That's a dark matter candidate. And it could be that this, the lightest supersymmetric, yes. It interacts with matter, yes, obvious, yes, it's true. It does interact with matter. It may interact only through weak interaction, for example. But the question is stability. It's not the same to be able to interact than to be able to decay. Like the electron interacts with matter, obviously, but it doesn't decay. Yeah, so the photon is, sorry, what about the? Yes. Yes.
But we don't see it.
Yeah, but that's the question that now the supersymmetric partner of the electron, this electron, is going to be heavier. We must make this guy heavier than the electron. Yeah. So there will be indeed an interaction of photon. Selectron's electron is going to be. But that doesn't tell you, having an interaction is not the same as being able to decay.
Right. But I don't mean that. I mean a scattering, right? Like electron.
Yes, indeed. So if there is a, well, we know there is a lot of
dark matter around us in our galaxy, and there's also a lot of matter in our galaxy, so we will expect that our supersymmetric particle, our dark matter candidate, that's scattered with the particles like photons or with electrons, with positrons. Yes, we do that. We expect that, and then that's why you get indirect constraints on your dark matter particle through scattering. Indeed. Okay, so there is this issue here. We say SUSY is great. It solves all my issues. It's the maximum tension, blah, 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 all this beautiful theoretical mathematical stuff. And as a byproduct, I get this very nice stabilization for the Higgs. But then, as usual, when I sit down and I look at the details, one of the consequences is that there's a bunch of light stuff that I should have seen and I haven't. So I need to break supersymmetry. And that's the key point. So if there is SUSY in any form at high energies, then SUSY must be broken so that, for example, the mass of this electron is much bigger than the mass of the electron. But we need to maintain the nice features for the Higgs potential. But we need to get still a breaking where all the contributions to the Higgs potential go still as logarithmic contributions. So that's what I want to obtain. And here you see exactly how it happens. Because I'm going to add something to supersymmetry to break it down and to make sure that the top and the top are not the same mass. So I'm going to get a contribution, but now the contribution is still logarithmic. So I have to break supersymmetry in a way that this is still a consequence of supersymmetry and touched by the breaking. Yeah. But once I split the masses in the supermultiplet, I do get a logarithmic contribution. Yes?
So what is M?
Yes, I'm saying that once I break supersymmetry, I'm going to get that there is some splitting between these two, right? So the splitting between the electron and the electron, I expect, is going to be of the order of the parameter breaking supersymmetry. Because before I break supersymmetry, those guys were exactly degenerate. Oh, sorry, and there should be a square here.
Oh, can you repeat the argument of why?
Yes. So one consequence of supersymmetry is that the mass of the fermion is equal to the mass of the boson. That's a SUSY consequence. So now I want to break supersymmetry. How do I break supersymmetry? Supersymmetry is broken at some scale. Let's call this scale M SUSY. M SUSY breaking. So what I know is that I want to break supersymmetry in a way that splits the masses inside a multiplet. So I expect that this guy, any difference between the boson and the fermion masses, must go as the SUSY breaking scale.
But so this means that every supersymmetric pattern is going to be shifted by the same amount.
If I were just doing one thing, one way of breaking supersymmetry, you will be completely right. Unfortunately, once you break supersymmetry, you introduce 124 new parameters to your theory.
Oh,
wow. Holy cow, yes. But you know, we are theorists, we are not discouraged by this. Because we see all the time symmetries that protect something. We see them, like they are real symmetries, and then they break down spontaneously, such as the electroweak symmetry or chiral symmetry in QCD. And some of the protection coming from these symmetries is still there, but some other consequences, well, are shifted, for example, this. So we are going to break supersymmetry, I guess, tomorrow in a way that we still get this. So we get the cancellation in the quadratic divergence. But then our contributions to the Higgs mass are going to go as the splitting, as the supersymmetric breaking scale. And indeed, because the standard model is a complicated, like, large sector of symmetries and particles. The MSSM is even bigger, and the ways you can break supersymmetry and still conserve this property are many. Introducing in your Lagrangian 124 new parameters that you should measure in an experiment. And so you can imagine there is no way we do that. So there will be a rationale for Susy breaking. But in principle, if you start counting parameters, there is more than 100 of them. OK. So if you don't have any questions, see you tomorrow.